You've included me too, right?
Two professors.
Is it okay now? It's not disturbing?
No.
It's the quality of the people.
The Keith Ward, Oxford professor in theology. I mean, he's a senior. Keith Ward? And he's an established senior scholar in Oxford. But he once said that in Oxford, no one comes to lecture. They just go to tutorial, like individual tutorials.
Yeah.
So that's why he writes a book based on his lecture.
Mm. Rather than lecturing in person.
Yeah.
It's like lectures aren't compulsory. They're not compulsory, yeah? Lectures
yeah.
Aren't
compulsory. Yeah.
We once had Jessica give a presentation, a full presentation and a talk, and it was only me and Richard Gombrich turned up.
Yes, to
but as you say rightly, the quality of the audience was excellent, so you don't need any. But you
it
had
disheartening for people sometimes.
There were many yesterday for your talk.
There was a few.
Yeah.
So you got through the customs?
Yes, thank God I got through the customs.
How long did it take?
Not the visa.
Right,
the UK immigration, yeah. It got delayed by a couple of weeks, and then I was supposed to be here a week before.
So when did you fly in?
Yesterday, last evening.
So you must be jet lagged. Oh no, not so much that way. Right?
Yeah, it's 5.5 hours. I'm okay now.
Only?
Four and a half hours, not 5.5 hours. From India?
It's 5.5.
India? In India, it's 4.5 hours ahead.
Oh, ahead, yes.
We are ahead.
Oh, ahead?
Now it's 6.30 in India.
Oh, I see.
So you're up very early in the morning and get tired in the late afternoon.
I don't know. At the moment, I'm okay, but this morning I woke up at about 1 o'clock and I couldn't get back to sleep after that. Well, yeah. But I don't think I'll get jet lag because I can sleep anytime. I like sleeping very much. No problem.
How long are you staying in it?
In here?
Yes.
Till June 21st. Yeah. You're from the center?
I live here. I'm German, but I live in Oxford.
Okay. All right.
I come to the Hindu studies course.
Oh, Hindu studies course.
And have all the sort of luxury of these extra lectures.
Okay.
That are being offered, which is wonderful.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, let's make a start. I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Sangeeta Menon from Bangalore. She did her initial degree in zoology, and was that in Kerala? You did a postgraduate degree in Kerala University on the concept of consciousness in the Bhagavad Gita. And you now teach in Bangalore at... you have to remind me which institution.
Yeah, but I'm not teaching, but this it's a research institution, National Institute of Advanced Studies.
Yes,
that's
yes.
Right, yeah.
And today she's going to offer her first Shibla Sani seminar on the idea of love with reference to the Narada Bhakti Sutras. And so I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to you, to our centre.
Well, thank you, Gavin. And thank you for all being here. I thought on a topic of love, the room would be flooded.
Yes,
not
in Oxford.
Not in Oxford, okay. So first I want to thank Professor Gavin Flood, Professor Shaunaka Rishitas, and the Center for having me here. It's a great privilege, great honor. Thank you so much. Well, this is not a lecture and it's a seminar, so which means it can be a lot of discussion and some of the ideas we are just floating around. So I don't have a paper to read, but what I was thinking is that we could discuss about love as an experience and how you would understand love also as another kind of experience which would connect you to something which you could call as sacred or something which you could call as of a transformative realm. So that's what I want to look at along with you this afternoon. The subtitle of my seminar says Western Ideas of Love, but I think we would restrict it to some particular context. I don't know how many of you have heard of Eric Fromm. right? Eric Fromm, he wrote a book on the art of loving. I don't know if you've read that. It's a very nice book, very nice book to read. There's certain, some of the interesting ideas which he talks about in this book, it's worth thinking about and reading more about it. One idea, I'm not talking about the book incomplete, but just taking a couple of ideas. He talks about different kinds of love and theory of love and so on, but I'm not going into that. But taking just three issues and then come back to Narada Bhakti Sutras. This is another text which is the authorship is not known and the date also is not much known, like many other literature which formed from oral tradition in India. But this again is a kind of a exhaustive treatise on love, but then love which is leading to or based on something sacred. But first, let's see some of the ideas which Eric Fromm says. He begins his book by asking, is love an art? He asks the question, is love an art? And then he says that if love is an art, then definitely it needs, like any other art, it needs knowledge and effort. So both knowledge and effort. And knowledge about what? He describes this in quite detail, but it's interesting just to have a peep into it at this point. He says knowledge about oneself and the other person. Knowledge about oneself and the other person. So in order to love, you need to have certain objectivity. Why we need to bring this issue here is, I think, personally, when you talk about love, especially in an academic circle, you know, usually our idea is that love or devotion is not something of a cognitive importance, right? It's not of certain scientific value, because it's something which is often given a kind of pejorative meaning, which can bring you down from your cognitive excellence. At least that's a popular belief, if not all. So Eric Fromm talks about objectivity as a necessary prerequisite for not only falling in love but also persisting in love, to be continue to be loving somebody. Or so he for him, to objectively understand the other person, to have the knowledge of the other, is very important to nourish and to see the various nuances of your own, the love between the two persons. So that's one idea which I thought is very interesting. And by bringing in objectivity, I think he likes to take love from a mere emotive experience to also a cognitive experience. So that's something which we could keep in mind and discuss later. If I am not clear enough, please stop me. Or if you have something to add, please stop me. So this is a seminar.
Yeah.
And then as I said, he considers love as an art. So he wants to build a theory of love as well as a practice of love. So, and he talks about various kinds of love, so that you can take a look at the book and see what are the different kinds of love which he talks about. One more interesting idea which I would like to present as far as Eric Fromm is concerned is that, why do somebody love? I think that was very important, because that's again this connection when we come to Narada Bhakti Sutra. I want to quote his own words. He says that the deepest need of man is to overcome his separateness, to leave the person of his aloneness. So there is this given or maybe acquired experience of separateness. Maybe it's a cultural product, maybe it's a social product, or it could be a sheer psychological phenomenon that in the midst of a crowd of loving people, loving entities, loving objects, loving environment, you can still feel completely separated out and could have certain narcissistic tendencies of your own identity. That's one sort of separateness. So there are, again, different ways of understanding separateness. But here, what Eric Fromm wants to say is that there is this constant urge for you to be united, to be united with the highest, or with, I mean, even if you don't call highest in regular day-to-day life, what you would consider as excellent, or what you would consider as worth to be attained, or what you would consider as worth to be known more. So when you love a person, you also want to know that person more. Or when you know a person, sometimes you tend to love less, but though they... But though it should have been the other way, or
yes, I was just reminded John Steinbeck, if mm-hmm. I get the right quote. He said, "If you really know somebody, really know them, you cannot help but love them."
Yeah,
the two go together.
Mm-hmm.
When you really understand, even a murderer,
yeah.
you really understand them deeply, you cannot help
mm-hmm.
but
yes.
be friendly.
Right.
It's better put the
call. That's interesting. That's interesting. So this is another idea which he talks about as separateness, which is the which is what is causing the urge for you to love and to be loved. I think since I want to focus on the Narada Bhakti Sutras and Eric Fromm's text, you can get it from around. Maybe you should consider reading that text. But this. Three ideas from Eric Fromm, I thought, had a lot of influence, at least as far as this text is concerned. I'm not sure whether he read or other Eastern literature, but I thought there is enough depth for these three questions. Maybe he has not dealt with its all complexities in its own book, but there is definitely potentiality for these three questions to be developed further. The first is how love can be conceived as an art, and then if it is an art, it requires knowledge and effort. And the other question to love somebody is to also to know that person, knowledge of oneself, not only to know the other, know the other person, you also know yourself. And this is very interesting. If you examine again, even our day-to-day life, when you love a person, it's at that juncture you know yourself. The best way to know yourself is to love the other person, because the reactive environment, your mental expressions, dispositions comes out in an interpersonal environment. The third idea which Eric Fromm puts is the idea of separateness as causing the urge to love and to be loved, because you want to be united with something higher, or something excellent, or something worthwhile to be. So these are the three ideas I would like to have from Eric Fromm. Unless you have some comments and questions, I would like to get into this text. As I said, we don't know who is the author of this text, like many other Indian texts, but it's a beautiful text. This text gives 84 sutras, or sometimes not sutras, a little bit worse style too. It has 84 comments or ideas about love, but mostly love as seen towards something higher, something sacred. But then as you see around, you would see that how even a day-to-day approach to love is integrated in an attempt to love something higher. Let me talk about a couple of these verses in the beginning, and then again tell you about 12 important expressions and ideas in the text, and then we could have a discussion. The first, like the text, this is mostly texts of this kind. The text starts with saying that, okay, now let's discuss about this text. So, adha bhakti vyakhya syamaha. So, now we will explain this again, adhado brahma jitnyasa, adhado dharma jitnyasa. Sorry about the Sanskrit, it's just because she is near.
It's lovely.
Yeah, it is assumed that before you enter into a discussion of something which is of complex nature, you have come with certain prerequisites. That is the meaning of adhato. Therefore, thereafter. So thereafter, because you need to have certain mental attitude and even certain physical requirements dispositions to enter into a discussion on something of a complex nature. So the text like Dharma or Jnana says that now we will start a discussion on this subject. It's not just an introductory time passer. It's not just it's not like a initial taster. I think it's an important statement. It says that we should consider the subject of discussion very seriously. And how do you consider it seriously? It's considered seriously by knowing that you just don't start the discussion on these subjects on a fine morning, but you would have completed something else before that discussion is started. So this again brings back to certain exercises, certain homework done, or maybe going through certain, sometimes people who has gone through life, you know, certain experiences, you are able to understand things in much complex manner. So here the first verse brings you the necessity of aptitude and qualifications for an aspirant, for a student who needs to understand what is bhakti. As far as this text is concerned, bhakti is discussed. And the second, it goes on, even if you read the first 9 verses of this text, it's very interesting. The second verse says, Sadhu Asmin Parama Prema Rupa. This divine love is directed towards something which is of a supreme nature. Your divine. How do you understand it? I'm trying to say it, how to understand in day to day, you know. I mean, though we use mystic and theological terms, how do we understand it? Even when you love a person in our ordinary life, you try to see excellence. You try to see the best in that person. Even if that person qualifies, sometimes he or she qualifies, sometimes she or not. But your aspiration is to see all kinds of excellence in that person. So love, somehow, it's a kind of a peak experience. It wants to reach a peak. It wants to touch the ultimate point of excellence. You're thinking something? Because I see your eyes moving.
I think all the time. I was thinking of the word that came to me was unifying.
Mm.
That love gives you the experience of non-separation. The ultimate experience,
right,
to me,
mm-hmm,
is when you feel connected to,
mm-hmm,
everything around you.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no I or you.
Yeah.
It's all united.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is,
mm-hmm,
the,
mm-hmm,
essence of... I was thinking, because you said something higher.
Yes.
But that is... That it goes in all,
yeah,
directions.
The way I showed, right?
It?
The higher. So there's... Well, I guess it's more in a metaphoric sense.
Sure.
When you talk about higher or broader or deeper, these are kind of human expressions to say something which is beyond our usual comprehension or regular usage, right? Day-to-day usage. So something to show which is, again, possible, more open spaces, or maybe to extend further. So what you said would be very appropriate there. So when you say higher, what you're trying to say is how to extend, which is a personal emotion, to an emotion which could be socially applicable, which could be applicable to the community, which could be applicable to, different layers of people and needs. Third says, Amrita Rupacha. You don't have to write down. You can find out the text later. It means this love, what we are talking about, is also the nature of immortality. Amrita, something which is devoid of mortality, something which is devoid of end. So we are talking about not an emotion per se, as far as bhakti is concerned, which begins somewhere, which has a certain advancement in the middle, and then finally collapses into nothing. No, we are not talking about that. But we are talking about something which is of an immortal nature, which wouldn't have an end. Why it is said so, that has to be seen and in the text as a whole. But the author gives you a taste of why he says it's immortal by the next verse said, El Ladva Puman Siddho Bhavadi Amrido Bhavadi Tripto Bhavadi. It's very interesting. I like this. whoever has got this kind of a devotion, I mean, it's kind of a love, which, as you said, which is extended towards everything, which is of a unifying nature, which reduces the separateness between me and the other, right? Such a love, one who is in possession of that, and one who is able to give that to others, he becomes the achiever of all times, Siddhobhavati. There's nothing more to achieve for him, he or she, nothing more to achieve. And he or she also becomes immortal in that sense. And Triptobhavati, I think that the last one is an interesting one, because discontentment is the curse of our civilization, and I think much of the present society. So this person becomes contented. A person who has received or is capable of giving such a love becomes a contented person. There is a sense of contentment, because in many a times our activities are inspired by discontentment, right? And there's philosophies built on that. How human action can be inspired by basic, essential discontentment. But here it is said that a person who has enjoyed, who nourishes love which is of this nature, that person becomes a contented person. So whatever he does is a result of his contentment, not for contentment. And it is not out of discontentment. The next one says, yat prapya, after once you have received this, na kinchit vanchati. You may question this, but this is what is said, that after you taste this kind of a love, where here the love is called as the ultimate love, the love which is of a devotional nature, love which is for the supreme or the most excellent. So once you taste that kind of a love, then that person wouldn't have further desires. So it doesn't mean that he stops functioning as a physical human being, right? Because as long as you are in the body, you need to have at least the desire to breathe, right? So you cannot say, then how can you say that there's no desire, right? When you say that after achieve this, you wouldn't have desire. It's difficult to understand, right? How can you have not desire, but at least the desire to breathe or desire to have the basic functions of the body, which is given, has to be there. So perhaps what we could understand is that desire for something per se, or desire for something, you didn't get that? Okay. Desire for something per se, you know, because in our regular life, in our day-to-day life, we find in the absence of certain things, we don't feel complete, right? In the absence of certain things, we don't feel good enough. We don't feel good enough to do many other things. If there are certain things, then we feel good enough to do many other things. So there is desire, there are desires for basic, there are certain basic things, then the desire for something which is a little more advanced, and so on. What you call as the needs, I don't know if anybody knows Maslow. Maslow talks about different kinds of needs. Abraham Maslow, he talks about different kind of hierarchy of needs. We all are ruled by certain hierarchy of needs. So how do you understand when you say that this person, he doesn't have any desire? How do you understand that he or she wouldn't have any desire? So it's not desire for a particular object. It's not the desire for something which would make that person complete, right? Because most of the time, we have a notion that when you fulfill something after you desire, that makes you a little more, you know, you feel good about it. But isn't it? You feel the sense of feeling good. But for this person, the sense of goodness is given to him. His expressions is out of that sense of goodness. So that is why it says that he no more would have any desires. He wouldn't have any more desires. Because all his desire is to be with something supreme. Something, and he is already achieving that. And the love which he is experiencing is facilitating him with the ultimate goal of any desire fulfillment. So desire fulfillment is not a goal in its own term for him, for such a person. He wouldn't have the project, different projects of fulfilling this many desires every day. Because whatever is to be achieved from the fulfillment of a desire, I mean, keeping apart all the other nuances of cultural difference or whatever, but the sense of contentment and feeling good is already bestowed with him. So he or she needs not have a separate project to achieve or to fulfill a desire to feel good. Is that okay? So, yeah. So, et prapyana kinchit vanchadi na shochadi. This person, such a person, when Shojadi, how would you understand? I mean, you can just say that, if you say that you don't feel sad, I don't know whether how correct it would be. But you know, we can understand displeasure and sorrow in many terms, in many ways. You know, the compassion.
Feel dejected.
Yeah, he doesn't feel dejected. Yeah. Also, I think when you talk about sorrow, there are different kinds of sadness, right? When you say that person doesn't feel sad, then you say that means he's not emotionally sensitive, because you need to feel sad. There's enough things happening around us which could make you feel sad. So how would you understand that? Perhaps it's not negating the possibility of compassion. Such a person becomes the epitome of compassion. It's not that you're ruling out of compassion. But sadness of a kinchitnyatva, maybe a limited kind of things, you know, small, small worries and small, small projects, small, small goals. And if they are not achieved, if I don't have tea at four, I don't feel that good.
He's not displeased or whatever.
Yeah. So maybe a person who is not shaken that fast, who is able to take the ups and downs of life in a relatively healthier manner. Then it said, na dveshti. He doesn't hold any anchor or a kind of a revenge to another person. Again, as you said, since this, the nature of this love is kind of relating to many things, objects, people, and environment around, the space between you and the other decreases, you know, as you advance. So such a person wouldn't have something to be averse from or to be displeased, as you said. What we have to keep here in this discussion is that the descriptions about such a person is done in very day-to-day practices. These are things which happen in day-to-day life. Then what is understood in such a context, how this person would behave. Na ramade. He wouldn't be kind of, he or she is not going to touch the floor or lie flat on the floor or touch the roof when things come to him. So which means he's not going to be over-related. Na ramade. It's not mean that he's not going to be happy or she's not going to be happy. But not to, which again brings the sense of balance of mind. So he and she will be an extremely balanced person. Situations, environments, or the fruits of the results of your actions, however the outcome would be, wouldn't influence this person to that extent that the environment around him is disturbed. The problem is many a times the outcomes, when you receive the outcome, when you respond to the outcome, it's not only that you are disturbed, the environment is also disturbed, right? Not only you disturb yourself, you disturb a few other people around you, right? When outcomes come and when you don't receive it in a certain manner. So na utsahi bhavati. I wouldn't know what would be the etymology of this word, but you may correct me if this is not. He may not be a person who would initiate things, you know, he or she would fall along with the course of events and how things goes, and then he would flow, he would move with the flow of the event. Yeah. It's not gender, any gender specific. I use the he because it's just coming. It's not that. It's not he. It can be he or she.
Better you use one.
Yeah. So yeah, that's right.
One doesn't.
Yeah, confuse. But it could mean person. It doesn't.
Yeah,
it's not specific. It is a person, he or she. Yatnyatva matto bhavati stabdo bhavati atma ramo bhavati. The person who has rejoiced this pure intoxicating love becomes intoxicated. It's matto bhavati. There's a sense of intoxication. Intoxication, right? Stabdo bhavati. Many a times you get stopped by shock, right? You don't know what to do about it. You just stand still psychologically and physically and maybe even cognitively. There is a stillness you experience. You do not know what to do or what to do next, what follows next. Atma Ramo Bhavati. I think this is a very interesting idea. Even if you look at Eric Fromm, you see this idea of the idea of self-love, which some other commentators have said that maybe self-love is not such a good word, self-appreciation or some could be a better expression for that. But Atma Ramo Bhavati, it's maybe not exactly in the sense Eric Fromm has used in his work, but Atma, how do you understand Atma Ramo Bhavati? Maybe you all have your own idea, so I should stop very soon. How would you understand an Atma Rama? Would you like to say?
Self-satisfied.
Yeah. Atma Rama, one who enjoys, revels in himself, right?
I'm reminded of the famous Gita verse, mm-hmm. Atmanyeva Atmana Tushtaha.
Yes, yes.
Sthita Prajnya
Tadochyate. Yeah. So
many of the things are just parallel to the Bhagavad Gita notion,
right,
of Sthita Prajnya.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Also the Bhakti Yoga,
yeah,
in that text.
But it's not meant in that sort of negative way, self-satisfied.
No. Atma Rama, I'm about to say that. It's not self-satisfied in the sense, not in any narcissistic sense.
Mm-hmm.
It means Atma Ramo Bhavati. It's again, we could look at it in a kind of a civilizational cultural context. In a regular given day, when do you become happy? When are you happy? Mostly, I mean, in general, if you take, you become happy when certain other things are also okay, right? I mean, however much we deny it, I don't think we can deny it to the fullest extent. There has to be certain kind of okayness to the situation or the environment, or at least one or two people around us for you to be okay, right? So, but here, Atma Rama, so how would you understand? It's not that somebody who is, it's not referring to a solipsistic kind of a extremely self-oriented, egoistic enterprise. But Atma Rama means not just also one who is not satisfied in oneself, in not that sense. Here, the whole notion of identity is different for that person. So when you talk about Atma Rama, the Atma they used is the whole notion of identity for him is different. The separation between the other and oneself is kind of quite minimal or kind of quite subtle in this case. So how would you understand Atma Rama? One who is unhappy in oneself, no, that could mean that whatever you do, you are happy about it, that's the worst situation, right?
One
however,
who doesn't depend on anything else for
absolutely
happiness.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what
usually
you don't...
Usually our happiness depends on good food, good surrounding,
yeah,
good relations, but one who doesn't depend on anything external for acquiring,
yeah,
happiness.
So whose happiness is not decided by something outside, he is called as an Atma Rama.
Atman Neva Rama.
So he is not decided. That means the whole world goes to... So you don't care where the world goes, how would you understand? If you don't mind what happens to the other, then you can still happy, right? We should question that. How would you understand that? Because if the world is in pain and if you think that you are happy inside, how would you understand that? The world is in pain and you say that you are happy with that. But then you understand pain in from a certain perspective, not from an egoistic perspective. Because the pain itself, most of the time, is a product of small identities, clashes, right? What you call as pain itself it's more a cultural phenomenon and more often psychological, and only fewer times it is really existential, and most of the time it is psychological. It is, it's kind of small, small things which hurts us and so on. So how would you understand Atma Rama? So who is not, it's not that he's a person who is insensitive to the world, the pain of the world, but who is able to project his compassion towards that pain from a higher perspective. The higher perspective in the sense, the perspective of the final unity of everything. So such a person wouldn't, first of all, see a divide between him and the other, or him and the supreme. Or it's more an ecological concept there, that of self-connectedness, connectedness of different things around. So for such a person, the joy comes not from external source, and not also from just his own self-restricted projects, but from a space which is more and more of uniting nature, uniting the other and yourself. So the identity of that person is of a different nature. So therefore, for him, the joy is not the similar to a joy which an ordinary person would enjoy, would have experience. The next one says, sa na kamayana nirodha rubatvad. It's again a further elaboration of that. Nirodhastu loka veda vyapara nyasaha. Well, this text goes on to saying that such a person wouldn't have many more initiating, many more activity initiating. That person would renounce secular as well as personal goal-directed activities. Which again we could understand in a certain way that this person wouldn't have anything else to do, but everything he would do is directed towards the something higher. So therefore he wouldn't have a separate goal to be achieved, but it is always connected with something larger, and therefore not a smaller project to achieve. And the last one, which is the ninth one of this text, which is not the last of the text. The text has 84 sutras, but the ninth verse I like very much, because it talks about a key expression: tasmin ananyata tat virodishu udasinata cha. I think it's very beautiful. It says that when you love a person, you feel a non-separate identity towards that person. It's very interesting. Eric Fromm talks about this non-separateness as the urge for somebody to love. But in this text, it talks about in terms of kind of love in a larger sense. Tasmin ananyata tat virodishu udasinata cha. So whatever reminds you of that love, that object of your love, here in this, as far as this text is concerned, of a divine nature, whatever reminds you of that, you feel a non-separateness towards that. So perhaps it's a leaf, but that leaf reminds you of your object of love. And so you feel that you are the leaf, right? So, and then whatever you think is distant from that, is causing you to move away from that object of love, you form a kind of dispassion towards that. Tad virodishu udasinata cha. Which means you always want to be reminded of your object of love, the other external agencies and objects around. You'd like them, you associate with them more in an intense manner when you feel that they are helping you to associate with something higher. So this particular expression of ananyada, tasmin ananyada, it's a nice word, ananyada. Mm-hmm. Anyada means separate. Anyada is separate, separateness. Ananyada means non-separateness. The 10th verse gives you a definition for what is ananyada. Anyashrayanam tyagaha ananyada, which means when you give up other ashrayas, other props, right? We have many props. You need to hang on to so many things in life to get life going on. When you give up all that, when you give up the last rope to hang, that is called as ananyada. You know, perhaps we could, I mean, the story which could be talked about is Panchali story when in that when she give up finally everything and then she calls out Krishna, Krishna comes and help her. I thought we would just talk about these 10 verses to begin with, but you might like to talk read the text in detail later. Maybe in then another 10-15 minutes, if I could take, maybe not 10 minutes, but if you take a cross-section of this text, you could see certain values. One thing you might be all familiar with as students, we all are familiar as students of Hindu and Indian literature, that for Indian literature or Hindu literature especially, a value is not something purely behavioristic or something of just a physical expression, but it also has a cognitive side to it, which means when you do something, when you practice something, it can change your ideas. So that is why knowledge, to have certain kind of a knowledge, you need to be doing something, which is may not be very Western, because if you purely bracket, to use the existentialist, the cognitive enterprise, you could say that one cognitive change leads to another cognitive change, or one idea leads to another idea, the other idea leads to idea. So it's a kind of a chain of ideas. But to take value itself as something which could cause a complete change in the way you understand and see things and the knowledge of entities is something, I think, very interesting as far as Indian philosophy is concerned. So therefore, value is very important. How you do your life, how you lead your life, for example, is very important as far as what is final knowledge is concerned, right? How you lead your life is very important as far as what is final knowledge is. So in this text, there are certain values or certain practices which are considered to be important to understand the nature of your object of love. As the text is concerned, it is something of a supreme nature. So when you have these values practiced in your life, or at least you approximate towards that, you understand, you get to know the person or the object which you're loving better. So what are these, some of this? To quickly, one is Vairagyam. These are some, again and again, discussed in many Upanishads and Gita, and as you said, Gita and other texts. But one is Vairagyam. Vairagyam is Viragada. Viragada is a kind of dispassion towards objects which keeps you away from what you love. Satsangam, to be in the company of people of good discussion, of discussion which would be of constructive nature. Mamata Tyagam, giving up of doership, giving up of an authorship for whatever we do and whatever we don't do also. So what we do and we... Mamata Tyagam, so giving up of sense of authorship, because it's again very difficult, because most of the time we would like to claim the authorship of things which we do. And it's very interesting, in cognitive science itself, the idea of agency is described as the who system. Means one who is behind a particular act, a cognitive act or a perceptual act, the who system. That's how they characterize agency here. But here is another notion of agency, which is absent of any kind of authorship. Mamata Tyagam. It's easy to talk about. I mean, I can very easily talk about it. With lots of words can be said about it, but I don't know how easy it is to experience it and to live it. Maybe a few moments, but to live it in a daily course of life. And one thing we have to remember is this is not just done in, we should not take it purely in a theological manner, because you know that in life situation also, whenever there need to be a conflict resolution and when the options are the same, you may have to give up certain things, right? The sense of renunciation is not always of a theological or a religious nature, but it is of so much of importance in even in day-to-day life. Especially when conflicts come. The fourth The first three, what I said, is comes in the 4 to 6th verse. The next in 4 to 7, Vijana Stala Vasam. So this such a person who wants to know the real secret of love and love towards the most excellent being, he should sometimes relish the experience of being alone. Mm-hmm. Means not, it's not in the sense of psychological aloneness that you are in the midst of 101 people, but still you say, I'm alone. It's not that aloneness it means. It really means vijana sthala vasam. Means sometimes you need to take a vacation to an island where you alone will be there, you know. So you need to be alone. It's very important that the space itself, it's relating to something very physical, not psychological. So you need to also have a physical space where you can be just be with yourself to allow that psychological expressions to be more prominent. Then, Loga Bandha Parityagam. It's difficult. Because most of the time, what we call as relationships are more of convenience or more of a cultural nature or more societal community allows. So here what's said is that you may have to give up certain relations which you have held together and thinking that that's the final. It could also mean that you don't expect something from any relations. It could also mean that. Nistraigunyatvam. It's if you had listened to Professor Kumar's talk, she talked about the gunas, sattva, rajas, guna. So such a person would be beyond the influence of the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. Yoga kshema nirasam. This person wouldn't covet for things, and he would not also preserve things. These are the two things, right? Yogam and kshemam. You try to achieve things which you don't have, and once you achieve, you want to preserve them. So get things, then possess it. Don't give it. Don't part it. I mean, the whole culture, the civilization is progressing on these two. Get more and more. Get more and more, and then consume more and more. But disposition is not. But then, at least today, I think we are increasingly knowing the necessity of how much it is important sometimes to dispossess. Karma bhala tyagam, which is giving up of, again, not taking the authorship of your activity. Not to relate all the products of your activity to yourself. Because, again, a sannyasi and a bhakti and a bhakta and a yogi are described to be people who create and then who move ahead. This is, again, a common feature of people who are of this nature. Who create? They create something, but then after creating, they don't hang on to cling on to that, which is of a regular nature. They create and then they go ahead. This is also described as the transcendental leadership. You know, you create something and then you live it, and then you go further and you create further. You create better things or other things. Karma bhalatyagam and karma sannyasam nirdvandva bhavam. is to be equanimous towards dualities. It's again a common value which is spoken about in many texts, nirdvandva bhavam. To be equanimous towards opposites, whether it's heat or cold, or sorrow or happiness, or victory or failure. Try to be equanimous. Try to take them in their stride. Then Vedokta karma sannyasam talks about doing certain activities as prescribed in the Veda, but maybe this can be discussed. I don't know how this is to be understood. Maybe it has to be understood in a larger context. And the final one, as I listed, this is just my listing, which is in the 49th verse, is kevala anuragam. Such person would be just kevala anuragam. He is not interested in anything else, but just kevala anuragam. Kevala means just that alone, one alone, right? Kevala anuragam, love towards that one alone, one with, of course, O capital. Why O capital? Not a divine which is alienated, but as you said, a divine which has percolated into whatever you saw as the other until that point. So these are some of the ideas from this text. Why I wanted to bring Erik Fromm is to just see that how he would have thought about the whole idea of separateness and how he would have thought the idea of separateness as discussed in this text. Because he thinks separateness as causing as that which causes the urge for you to love somebody and to unite. And also I think it's important to understand love not just as an emotion. Love not as an emotion, but as perhaps a complexity of emotion. I don't know how many of you have heard of Paul Ekman. He is a person who works on emotions and body language and face and so on. He talks about certain basic emotions, what he calls as basic emotions, like the Natya Shastra in the intertext of Indian dramaturgy talks about rasas and bhavas. He is reluctant including love as a basic emotion because he thinks love as a combination of several factors. As far as this text is concerned, love is not just an emotion which is directed towards one person, which has a beginning, which has a middle point and end, but it is an experience which is at one. It is an experience from one side. It is of a transformative nature. And the other side, it is of an inclusive nature. It reduces the space between you and the other. And in the process of reducing the space between you and the other, it transforms your way of thinking and your way of including the other in your larger worldview. I think I should stop now. Mm-hmm. You should listen to. I remember your face from the website. Yeah. Your last name is Gupta, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So you were acquainted before you came.
Yeah. So we were discussing about love, as in Erik Fromm. We discussed this text. I don't know if you have known this text. It's Erik Fromm, psychologist. He wrote on The Art of Loving. And some of the ideas we discussed, what he says. And because one common theme, but may not be of same relevance, is he talks about non-separateness.
Mm-hmm.
And this book also has the idea of ananyata, non-separateness.
Mm-hmm.
So the terms that Narada would be using would be something like bhakti, as I mean, and
mm-hmm.
would you think that love is a good translation of that term?
Well, I'm sure love is not a good translation for that. But then, I don't think a person can be called a bhakta if he's not able to love. Because when you call devotion, it's refined love, right? Because usually when you say love is for a particular person or a particular object and for limited possibilities and limited goals. When you call bhakti, it is for unlimited possibilities, it's not to a particular person, right? So the whole space of your heart and your being is expanded. But then the holy way to understand devotion is to, I think, to accentuate or to refine your capability to love another person. How would an ordinary person understand? Ordinary in the sense, regular, in a regular life, how would you understand? How would you understand devotion? How would you understand bhakti? So it can only be understood by pointing towards the way he would love another person, right, on another object. So definitely love is not a good translation for bhakti, but I think we need to talk about love in order to understand devotion.
Is bhakti then a transformation of a basic human emotion that would be a kind of universal? So you're kind of disagreeing with Ekman in a way,
mm-hmm.
In the sense that if love is a basic human emotion, which is then transformed in culture-specific ways that Narada is talking about. That was a proposition.
That's fine.
I'm just trying to get, so bhakti is the directionality,
uh-huh.
Is love,
mm-hmm.
which as a basic human emotion directed at a particular kind of object. Is
mm-hmm.
that right? And the and the object has to be specific.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be a general object, can it?
Where in love,
bhakti.
Right? In bhakti. It cannot be general, you said?
Yeah. It would have to be a specific object.
Well, see, in bhakti, I'm remembering a verse in my own language, which it says the translation would be that person, wherever he looks, whatever he sees, he wants to see his object of love, you know. So, yatra yatra mano yadi tatra tatra samadhi, right? So, wherever your mind goes,
yeah.
there all those places you see your object of love, the divine love. Right. So for that person, it's specific in the sense, it's not just, it could be an entity which has a name and a form, but it is also kind of extends all over.
Yeah.
But then, I think even in the cases of love, you can understand this. At least when you start loving a person, or for a mother or a child, you know, you would, for a mother, whatever the mother sees around would remind her of her child, her son or her daughter, right? So, in bhakti, it is it could have a name and a form, but then that name and form is very ethereal, I would think, because wherever.
But I think there is a difference of degree in love and devotion, because as far as I remember, the definition of bhakti that Narada has given, this is paranurakti. So the ordinary love is only anurakti, but this is para anurakti. Is it in this?
Parama prema rupa, that is.
I think this is para anurakti, Ishware para anurakti, Shandilya Sutra maybe, this is not Narada Bhakti Sutra. So that is the difference of degree.
Mm-hmm.
And ordinary love cannot be characterized as bhakti. This is the highest form of anurakti, that is bhakti.
You can say you're doing your garden with devotion. Right, that's a problem with translation, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's very easily used, you know, that you do something, you bake a cake with such devotion.
Mm.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
As you say, it's degree.
Yeah.
It talks about a...
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So. Yeah, but in English we might say we cook this cake with devotion, but in Sanskrit we would never say, use the term bhakti for that ordinary level, because that is only... As you said, directed towards the supreme being, bhakti.
Thank you. What is actually the word for love in Sanskrit?
Sneha, anuraga, prema.
Oh, prema, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And how does ananda, is that just
bliss?
Bliss, just
ananda
bliss.
Ananda is bliss.
Sometimes also translated as love and joy, isn't it?
Satchidananda is a common expression.
Yes,
which,
Satchidananda is not love.
It's not love.
Rati, arati, anurakti, prema, sneha.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you can interpret that a happy person would definitely be able to love another person.
Yeah.
You can interpret that way.
So it seems that love requires that there be a beloved and a lover. So when it comes to those Indian traditions which have a sort of exclusively impersonal understanding of the Absolute or of God, then what place does love have for them?
Well, impersonal understanding of that's one tradition, but we have a whole lot of literature which talks about so many nuances of very personal nature.
Sure, but
we look at Gita Govindam or the Alwars or the Namanwars literature, how much they are oriented with that.
So you don't think for the impersonal traditions there's any applicability with the term love?
The impersonal tradition?
Yeah, do you think that they can't use the term love?
Oh, definitely, of course.
So I fail to understand how they do. I mean, how can they really use that?
That depends upon how we understand impersonal. In what we understand impersonal.
Just like a monistic eschatology that ultimately you will merge into.
Yeah, well, that's, I would like to disagree there, I mean, if I may. Because as far as Shankaracharya is concerned, he doesn't talk about an absolutism which is completely being insensitive to the rest of the world. The final realization is including the world in your realization. It's not giving up. It is non-dual. It is finally kind of understanding that the world you experience and your ultimate nature need to be understood in a non-dual sense. It's not giving up of something. The final liberation for a knowledge tradition like Advaita, it's not a solipsistic, a single experience. It is not a customized experience for that person alone. It's not a privileged experience. Mm-hmm. It's not where that person is able to get rid of everything. No, it's not. So but it's including everything.
Where does
but
that fit into that?
Well, I think love falls into that very meaningfully, because when you see that the other world has a meaning, has a certain value, then definitely love would fall into it. The whole idea of Maya is not negating the world, but to see the world in the context of something perhaps more permanent, as the tradition would use the word, more everlasting. So it depends upon how we understand the absolutistic tradition. This absolutistic tradition is not giving up the world or negating the world in the sense this world that doesn't have any meaning at all. It's not in that sense. But the meaning and the value of the world has to be understood in a larger context, which is the context of Brahman, if that tradition is discussed. So it is not negating the world per se. And since it is not world negation, but it is a world inclusion, love and compassion and all other, a lot of values.
I'm sorry, I find it difficult to understand. If I can ask another question.
Sure.
But at the point of death is what I mean. At the point of death, mm-hmm. you're talking about love as being eternal, as being without beginning,
right.
without end.
Mm-hmm.
So for an Advaitin, at the point of death, there is really no beloved.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. love would appear to be temporary.
Yeah. Well, here, when I said love, it's always love pointed towards something excellent, and that is why it is bhakti.
Mm.
Okay? So that's why it is eternal. The love which you experience in day-to-day life, which has limited, it is limited, it has limited goals, limited level of fulfillment, right? That is definitely mortal. But something which you is directed towards the excellence, since the degree of excellence is not scalable, you know, your love is immortal. It doesn't end, because you are, the bhakti is pointed towards something whose value is not scalable. You cannot scale it. You cannot say that the object, the God, or what is supreme, is has certain limit. At least in this, that if you read the tradition, if you look at the devotional literature, the beloved is considered to be far excellent. So I forgot what. So what did you say? So in death, what happens, right? What if?
Can I ask Chris's? Let me re-ask it in a sense, in my own terms. If love has always has an object in the human world, and bhakti is that kind of emotion directed or sublimated or something towards a transcendent object, does that object have to be specifiable? Or perhaps this is a way of asking the question: is nirguna bhakti possible?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is possible. If I may just add to it, that whatever the Atmavat Sarva Bhuteshu Yaha Pashyati Sa Pashyati. So there you don't have to divide as a subject and as an object. But just as the Upanishad say, Atmanastu Kamaya Sarvam Priyam Bhavati. Just as everything you love for yourself. So like yourself, you see everybody else. There is no duality.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the way of loving or extending your love towards the world.
Nirguna bhakti can be there. Nirguna bhakti, how do we understand it? I mean, if we come out of the etymology and the strict Sanskrit expression of how do you understand nirguna bhakti? Nirguna bhakti means devotion to something which need not necessarily having a name and a form, right?
Yeah.
That's what you mean by nirguna bhakti. The other is saguna bhakti, which has certain gunas, certain name and form. So how can you love something which is not having a name and a form?
Mm.
And as far as those tradition is concerned, Brahman is described as something which is not having a name and a form. How do you have bhakti towards that? I think the one way of understanding is that nirguna bhakti is directed towards everything. Since Brahman is everything, your bhakti is directed towards everything.
That's what it
so
says.
That's
that see everyone as your own self. That's it. Atmavat sarva bhuteshu. So he is the true jnani or the pandita who sees everything and everyone as oneself.
That would seem to be dependent on being in a human form.
Sorry?
That would seem to be dependent, that particular perspective, on being in a human body. So uh-huh. how can that love continue at the moment of death when one leaves the body?
Which one? When you leave the body? I don't know what happens after you leave the body. So
the love can't continue, presumably.
Yeah, because for them,
I don't know either that.
For them, love or any consciousness or awareness is not a property which has left after death. It is the nature of the consciousness.
Not necessary. Even if you take the theory of rebirth in to understand this, it's possible to love somebody even in various lives. There are several stories in our literature which shows that person can.
I kind of at the end, moksha, final birth.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't seem. I'm sorry. Just.
Yeah, it depends upon Chris. It depends upon how you understand moksha.
Yes, but so they think about it from the impersonal point
yeah,
of view.
Yeah, so even from the impersonal point of view, moksha is not alienating yourself from the rest of the world. It is understanding the distance between you and the world in a larger context. The whole idea, your question becomes relevant only if you are negating the world, or if you are saying that in the final sense there's no world, only Atman. What do you mean by that? Is this Atman a particularly customized product which you get? It's not
it's
that.
It's beautifully said in one of the Upanishads, Brahma Veda Brahmaiva Bhavati. He who knows Brahman, he himself becomes the Brahman.
Yeah.
So there is no difference at that level.
That's the point. If there's no difference, then how can there be love? Because in one, for love, one really does.
No, there is. If I may put so, there could be a difference, but there's no division. You may understand that the other person has certain differences, but there is no ultimate division. Essentially, you understand the connectedness between the person.
Mm.
So it's possible to love a person, understanding that there certainly there's a lot of difference, but essentially there is something which connects.
Is maybe devotion the act of loving, and it comes from a dualistic perspective, i.e. there's me and there's other, the other which I love, which means I don't feel connected, but through my devotion I will, and when that occurs, that moment of merging, it's beyond devotion. It's a state of bliss, oneness, beyond, which is so difficult to talk about because poetry says it best. It's very difficult
to explain. What happens
we get
after
lost
moksha
on the mind level
yeah,
if we do that
right.
too much
you can't
because it's a feeling beyond the mind.
So can only talk about the experiences that are in this world and at this level. At that level we cannot say what happens and how it happens.
Well, but I mean if you say love is eternal, then that has to continue, that relationship should continue, and that means even after attaining moksha or whatever, that some sort of duality must be there.
Why it is said eternal? Because here, as love directed towards bhakti is eternal.
Mm-hmm.
Why it's eternal? Because that object of love or bhakti here is that excellence, as I said, it's not scalable. It doesn't have an end. So you cannot exhaust your love for that supreme object. And that's why it's bhakti. It's immortal because in ordinary sense, it begins, it peaks, then it dies off, right? Something like that. But here, there's no possibility for these kind of time scales to happen.
But then you said there's no possibility for you exhausting your love. But then that's, given that we can't talk about it in words because it's beyond conceptuality, but then you're still saying that there's that duality
in
those words.
Sorry?
When you're saying that it's beyond, our love is, I forgot what you just said, what I just quoted.
No, you can say what you want to say, it's
well,
okay.
I'm trying to remember what you
just said. Inexhaustible love?
Yeah, when you're saying that our love for that is inexhaustible, then you're still, there's duality inherent in what you're saying. You're saying our love for that is inexhaustible.
Mm.
So it seems that even when you're trying to answer a question like that, you have to revert to dualistic language, so...
Bhakti, doesn't bhakti presuppose duality? It does.
So what did you have in mind? Duality persists, or what?
Sorry.
I didn't quite understand. So what's your argument?
Well, just in answering that question, you have to say that your love for it is inexhaustible. So that again, you've got the subject and the object.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only way you can explain love. So
right.
I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. So that
duality
would be
always there. Mm. Duality in the sense, well, you cannot love yourself. That's one thing, right? So maybe that's one point. Can you have bhakti towards yourself? Yes, you can have bhakti towards yourself if you see yourself as everything else.
I just had an idea when you were saying that. If you have devotion for the Supreme, my idea of the ultimate, through my devotion, that is a way to connect to it and touch it. And when I'm successful in that, something flows back. And this is a never-ending thing.
Never-ending because the object
you activate something beyond just this through the love in the heart or the devotion in the heart, because it feels a lot better than just being identified with this mortal lump. And it's subtle, isn't it? It's not. And we have to put effort into it, as you said at the beginning. What did you say? Effort and
knowledge and effort.
And knowledge, and through this comes insight often, doesn't it? When that love, when this connection happens, the mind expands, becomes more conscious, and you get insights about the mystery of life. You get deeper questions answered, and this is the cognitive side of the other side, love and consciousness going together.
It seems that Western psychologists have classified this, though, as the object relations theorists, as in the three types of religion they generally talk of, then the sort of monistic religions are generally classified as being sort of self-religions, and that's where the whole concept of Gnosticism comes from, because ultimately you're sort of loving yourself in the final thing. So you don't think they're right?
You mean isn't such a possibility there in absolutist tradition, or that's what you're asking?
I don't think so,
because when you, even though you use word self more for a linguistic convenience, what is meant is the self which is everything else. So therefore it's not necessary.
See, Shankaracharya himself was the great devotee. Although he propounded this philosophy of non-dualism, but he wrote a text called Saundarya Lahari. And he's a bhakta in Viveka Chudamani and all other texts. He's himself a great devotee, because he's also talking of two levels. So that level which you are talking of, the absolute level, that is not for us ordinary mortals. We are living at another level. So this is the phenomenal level or the empirical level. And at that ultimate level, for Shankara at least, bhakti can never lead you to liberation. That is only knowledge and knowledge alone. He's so emphatic about it. Because bhakti presupposes duality, and he's not going to accept that. So it's only knowledge which can lead you to liberation. Bhakti is a means to knowledge.
Yeah.
But knowledge is a means to liberation.
Yeah. Narada would presumably claim that love was a form of knowledge, though, wouldn't he?
But because he is predominantly a bhakta, and Shankara is a jnanin. So this interrelation of jnana, karma, and if you read the Gita, you're not sure. If you read the bhakti yoga, you feel as if that's all. If you read the jnana yoga, that's all. And there is one of the commentators, he says that there are 18 chapters in Gita. 6 of them speak of karma, then the next 6 speak of jnana, and the last 6 speak of bhakti. So that is the supreme in Bhagavad Gita. So this interrelation between these three is also very debatable. As you said, Eric Fromm says that knowledge and effort are needed for love. So, and the person who follows the path of knowledge would say that bhakti is necessary for knowledge. So it's the ordering which will change, but none can deny each one of them. All the three are necessary. Effort is karma, jnana is knowledge, isn't it? And love is desire or bhakti.
I was just curious, in the Nada Bhakti Sutra, how does he define, I'm sorry I came in late, maybe you discussed about this, but what love is itself. So, like, you know, in the sciences, it's often described as a, if they're purely physical, then chemical thing. Otherwise, it's described as, you know, mental, sort of an emergence, sort of a mental phenomenon. So, in the Nanan Bhakti Sutra, what is love itself? Is it mental, or is it part of this Atma? Is it part of the self itself? Is it spirit?
Yeah, this text talks about love towards the Supreme, and therefore bhakti. Okay, so that we have to keep in mind, not love in the regular day-to-day sense, but love oriented towards the Supreme, and therefore of devotional nature. So it definitely doesn't say that love is neurochemical, which is much more a recent understanding of love. That's definitely a valid way of understanding, but... there are a couple of ideas. In one key idea, I would think, is tasmin ananyata, which is non-separateness.
Mm.
Non-separateness is the key definition for bhakti.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So, in terms of its,
which
nature.
Again, if you think a little deeper, which is more a cognitive concept.
Mm.
So, like you said. Could interpret bhakti, therefore, as a cognitive experience, not purely, because to feel non-separate, again, you need to have a certain sense of objectivity is disappearing there, right? Non-separateness. You need to have certain idea of what is separate, and when you say non-separateness, I think it's interesting to think more about it as a cognitive concept too.
Mm.
So I guess then, does it rest in the Atma itself, or is it
which one?
This bhakti,
mm-hmm.
the non-separateness. On what level does it rest? Is it on the level of the Atma or the mind, the manas? On what level? What does it constitute? Mm-hmm. What does it say?
If it rests on the mind, that becomes a tool for that person to achieve it in more subtle level.
Mm-hmm.
And a person who has achieved it, for that person, definitely that is his expression of his Atma.
Mm-hmm.
So like in Gita it says, one who has mastered it, for that person, yoga becomes an expression. And one who is a student of it, it becomes a means. Arirukshor munir yoga. Karma karana muchyate. Yoga rudasya tasyeva shamakkaranam ichyate. For a person who has accomplished it, that becomes his nature. It's his expression. You cannot be different. But to a person who's trying to achieve it, that becomes a means. So bhakti, you cannot be understood in that sense, both as a means and also as a siddhi.
Yeah, it's interesting, this tasmin ananyata, this sort of non-separateness from it. I guess from the object of love, but at the same time, the some devotional strand within Hinduism also talk about the separation, like the viraha bhakti, the importance of separation within the context of bhakti, because that actually further enhances the longing towards that spring. So I'm just curious that if Narada Bhakti Sutra talks about
yes, it
separation.
Talks about certain verses which says that whatever separates this person from that object of supreme excellence, that's of no interest to this person.
Mm.
And so there is a place for viraha bhakti here, but that's again towards leading to non-separateness.
Mm.
You have the pang of separation because you love to be non-separate.
Mm.
Right.
So he doesn't really, how do you say,
mm-hmm.
talk about separation per se as something of value.
Well, separation is, he talks about separation as something could happen to this person, because anything that which separates this person from that object of devotion is not stable, because he cannot be staying in that kind of existence for long, because he would always like to be non-separate.
Mm.
So whatever takes his attention away from the supreme object of love, that's something he would like to avoid. A lot of verses which talks about that. But then you have to understand viraha bhakti in the sense of viraha in the sense, not it doesn't, viraham is not an ultimate by itself. You have to understand that viraha is again for union, right? So that longingness for to be united, so again this pang of separation to be united.
I'm going to ask another sort of more philosophical question. When so it seems that, again, talking about the Nirguna Brahman sort of conceptions of the absolute, then it seems like the whole cosmic Leela is about the Jivas.
Cosmic what?
Leela is coming about, the Jivas coming back, sort of uniting with the absolute. And that seems to be the sort of the basic motif of love in general, is that the separateness is being diminished. And so you have this eternal phenomenon of the merging, as it were. And so that's love. But when I think about that in terms of the sort of impersonal Indian traditions, then I always think, then why is there hatred? I mean, why is there such sort of agonizing pain? I mean, the opposite of love in the world. Is it purely because love is not possible without there being some sort of, you know, horrible events happening in the world, or...?
Why there is hatred?
That's a big question.
That's a big question.
That's a big question.
It's a big question.
Put a lot in your questions.
That's a big question. That's fine. That's a big question.
But
if there is all love, why there is hatred? I personally think hatred wouldn't have a long-term existence. At some point, it may have to give way for love.
Maybe to enhance the value of love.
And also we need to know that as far as two different minds interact, when two minds interact, two bodies interact, it's inevitable there would be certain negative products also of it. You cannot always anticipate everything to be positive out of interpersonal dynamics, especially when we're talking about dynamics between communities, societies, and economic disparity, cultural differences, and so on. So, and when the resources are so limited and there's so much competition to achieve, I think hatred is inevitable. And sometimes it becomes a civilizational advantage, because I'm not advocating hatred, but it becomes a competitive edge, you know.
Particularly when the lower needs are unsatisfied.
Absolutely.
When those lower needs are unsatisfied, we can't advance up to the heart level. And then we get into competition, territorial survival, and then the animal comes out and slaughtering and everything.
So it's more natural, I would guess. But the first part I didn't quite follow. So
I think it will have to remain unfollowed at the moment. We've come to 3:30. Thank you so much. Extremely stimulating and thought-provoking seminar. And it's there's a whole new set of questions have just arisen, I think, in the last kind of thing that you were referring to. And it's made me think very much about the nature of language in devotion. You were talking about the cognitive nature of bhakti as well as its emotional dimension.
Yeah.
And so it'd be very interesting to pursue those questions further, perhaps next time. So thank you so much for an extremely stimulating seminar.
Yes,
thank you.
When are you coming again? You're giving more lectures?
Yeah? Yes, it's announced on the website. One of the date, I'm not sure, which was supposed to be on 27th, but I think it just rescheduled, right?
Yes.
I don't know the date.
So the next one is on Tuesday, isn't it? On Monday.
The next lecture?
Your next session. Your next session is on Monday.
Monday.
7th is Monday?
Yes, it's on Monday.
Yours is on Monday too?
We've got one in the morning and the afternoon.
Okay, mine is...
No, I'm not talking on the day.
Right.
That's not me. That's
so
somebody else.
Yours is in the afternoon.
Right.
So won't it be a heavy dose otherwise? We already have so
much
audience. Then
there's two pictures. Yes, it'll be I don't know how to turn this off.
No, couldn't be there.